This is Dr. Shannon M. Clark with A Doctor Delivers Podcast, and today I will be discussing PCOS and fertility and pregnancy with reproductive endocrinology and infertility specialist, Dr. Lucky Seacon. Have a listen. So today I'm being joined by Dr. Lucky Seacon of RMA Fertility in New York. We are going to discuss as both a maternal fetal medicine specialist and a reproductive endocrinology and infertility specialist, PCOS. And it just happens to be PCOS Awareness Month, which I think is excellent. And I totally skipped my mind with everything else going on in the world with COVID and pregnancy and all that right now. And Dr. Seacon just reminded me and said, hey, let's do this. And here we are.
Yeah, I think it's such an important topic. It's such a common problem.
Yeah.
And it's also, it wins the award for most misunderstood.
Absolutely.
Conditions.
Yeah. You know, and I don't diagnose PCOS. I'm a maternal fetal medicine specialist. My patient's already pregnant. But I will say, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this, I'm not going to pretend that I'm an expert at all. That's why you're here. But for two reasons. Number one, so much has changed since I went through training from 2000 to 2004, my residency. Plus, I can't tell you of the countless number of times I've heard from pregnant individuals who have PCOS that were told at a very young age, you have PCOS, you're never going to have a baby. You're never going to be a parent. And that's so damaging. And, you know, it's so traumatizing. And although it's a very complex disorder and it's still probably evolving over time, I don't think that's quite fair to label someone that early on.
Right.
Do you hear that? Yeah.
I hear it all the time, and I think label is the perfect word because a lot of times people who are coming to me are healthy, young, have not had to see many doctors in their life, and they're coming to me because they don't know why they are not getting their period regularly after going off of the pill. That's like the most common scenario. And when I start to talk about PCOS, all they're hearing is diagnosis, label.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel like I've just gone from being a seemingly healthy individual to now having this scary disease. And it sounds scary too. I think PCOS needs a rebrand.
Yeah.
Polycystic ovary syndrome. Like, what does that even mean? You know, we all have follicles in our ovaries, which by definition are cysts because they're fluid-filled spaces that each contain an egg. And when people hear the word cyst, they automatically get very afraid because there's different kinds of cysts, and something that sounds like you have many cysts is automatically scary. So people feel labeled. I usually try to explain it by saying it's not really, yes, it is technically a type of syndrome or a condition, but I wouldn't think about it like a disease. It's almost like an alternate state of being. And it has a wide array of manifestations. Not everyone's going to have the same level of PCOS or the same types of symptoms or signs or risk factors associated with it. It's so common, and it affects 1/10 of the population.
Right. And I think it's also important to be diagnosed by someone who understands PCOS, that is up to date on the literature, who does this for a living, and knows PCOS inside and out. Because, and I've done some reading from preparation for this talk with you, it's considered a diagnosis of exclusion. Explain to those listening first, what is a diagnosis of exclusion and why PCOS is considered a diagnosis of exclusion?
So PCOS is based, the diagnosis itself is not based on one thing alone, right? There's different types of criteria. The most famous criteria out there says you have to have at least 2 out of 3 of the following. One, irregular or absent cycles. That indicates that you have irregular or absent ovulation, right? Two, either lab tests or just physical signs and symptoms that you have an overdrive of male-type hormone called androgens, things like testosterone in your body. This can manifest as acne, alopecia, meaning hair loss where you normally shouldn't have hair loss, and hair growth where you shouldn't have hair growth, like upper lip, chin, chest, you name it. And then also the third thing that can happen is having an appearance of polycystic ovaries. What that really means is an ovary that's crammed or packed with follicles. There's this special terminology we use called string of pearl, meaning it looks like the follicles are kind of lined in a perfect, along the periphery of the ovary on ultrasound. But technically we say if you have at least 12 follicles or more in each ovary, if the volume of the ovary is above a certain size, two out of the three of the following, and that gives you the diagnosis of PCOS. I think that it's important to realize that not everyone is going to look the same. No two PCOS patients will be identical in terms of the things that they're facing. And it is not something that is entirely clear. There are a lot of other conditions that can masquerade as PCOS because things like having low thyroid function can also lead to irregular or absent ovulation or cycles. It can also lead to obesity or weight gain, which also can look like PCOS. The other aspect of PCOS that I think doesn't really come through with those three diagnostic criteria is the metabolic problems that can come with it, right? And that's something that isn't true for everyone, but in general, women with PCOS might have a tendency towards diabetes, high blood pressure, weight gain, especially around the central location, their abdomen. And these are things that are very much linked to what's happening in the ovary. The high androgen levels that are found coming from the ovary are oftentimes linked to high levels of insulin in your body. And that is a connection that's very hard to explain, right? There are these three seemingly unrelated things that are very linked: the irregular cycles, the excess androgens, and then this metabolic issue and having a predisposition towards diabetes.
When someone comes in that looks like they meet, and you mentioned the Rotterdam criteria, which is what it's called with, I think you mentioned that with the oligo or anovulation, the biochemical or clinical signs of hyperandrogenism, and then the polycystic ovaries. If they meet those criteria, you can't just assume that's what it is because there's other things, like you said, that are masquerading. So you, especially if they're young, you want to make sure they don't have something like congenital adrenal hyperplasia as teens that is causing this. The thyroid disease, and some other things that,
Hyperlactin
yeah,
levels.
high prolactin levels. So there's other things that have to be ruled out before the diagnosis can be made. And that's extremely important. And that's another reason why being worked up, meaning worked up in medical terms means you're seeing a physician, they're working you up for the diagnosis by ordering the appropriate tests, doing the appropriate physical exam, ordering the appropriate imaging. In this case, it would be a pelvic ultrasound. They're working you up to put all the pieces together to hopefully provide a diagnosis. And one of the things I hear all the time is that it takes so long for some people to get a diagnosis of PCOS. So why is that?
I think it's just not on everyone's radar, right? Not everyone is thinking about PCOS. It's not top of mind. This is something I think about every single day. It's what I do day in, day out. But for other people, they're not, especially if the patient's coming to them and not coming to them with a specific problem. They're not trying to conceive and saying, hey, I can't track my ovulations appropriately. This is a problem for me. Then maybe a light bulb would go off and they'd focus on it as a problem. But if they're coming just for a regular GYN checkup and they mention that they get their period every 40 days or 45 days, it might just not be top of mind or the focus of that consult. And I think a lot of, I think it's on both sides, both the physician and the patient side. Everyone's very goal-oriented. So unless it's a problem for you because you need to be tracking your ovulation and trying to conceive, a lot of people don't think of PCOS as being relevant. But that couldn't be further from the truth. I think it's important whether or not you're trying to conceive.
Well, like you said, it's very common. It's the most common endocrinopathy affecting reproductive age individuals that produce eggs. So, and the other thing is, if they have to, they don't get a diagnosis until they're actually trying to conceive, then you've missed all this time where it could have been managed appropriately. So, as an obstetrical or a gynecologic care provider, keep it on your radar if you're listening to this. They're not having regular periods. They might have signs of hyperandrogenism. Go ahead and initiate the workup now rather than waiting until that individual's trying to conceive and we missed time where that could have been diagnosed. If you're a patient and you're not having regular periods or you're not sure if you are, talk to an obstetrical or OBGYN about what's going on with you. If you're having some of the signs of hyperandrogenism that Dr. Seekon just mentioned, ask, hey, could this be PCOS? Is this something I need to be worked up for? Advocate for yourself so that we don't miss time and it's not even thought about until the individual's having trouble to conceiving. Would you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. I also think it's not just about, okay, if you need to ovulate, we'll give you medication to ovulate. If you're not getting a period and you're not trying to conceive, let's just put you on the pill. A lot of people think of that binary,
That's one or the other. Yeah, it's one or the other.
Right.
Yeah.
But what about looping in a nutritionist? You know, if some, not all PCOS patients are going to be obese or overweight. Right. That's another reason why it's often missed, because yes. people are thinking of what was traditionally known as Stein-Leventhal syndrome. Yes. It's a specific.
That's what I was taught. Yeah, that's
correct.
What I was taught.
Exactly. Whereas yeah. now what I see on the ground in the trenches as an REI is I see a lot of really lean women that are doing all the things to take care of themselves. They're maintaining a normal body weight. They're eating, you know, the good, healthy types of carbs. And they're doing everything that they could possibly do to control the metabolic side of things, but they still get irregular cycles. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, all the other things are excluded, and we know it's PCOS. So there are many different types of PCOS. Now we talk about lean PCOS. There's so many different subtypes. And I think that it was traditionally very oversimplified. And that's also why a lot of these cases were missed.
Well, it was a stereotype. We were taught that the patient looked a certain way. And right. now we know that's not the case. And so some of, you know, we have to get that out of our mind. And as someone who's doing general care, especially OBGYN, we have to get that stereotype out of our mind and realize we have to look about, you know, ask certain questions, because like we said, it's common and yeah. we don't want to lose time. Okay. So let's jump to, you know, the first criteria, irregular cycles and ovulatory dysfunction. What does that mean? And what does that look like for someone with PCOS?
So the best way to figure out if someone's ovulating, how frequently they're ovulating, the only real sign that we have to go off of is when they menstruate, right? Mm-hmm. And so if someone's getting regular menstruation, you can assume that they probably ovulated about 2 weeks before the first day of their period. So you can use that as a marker. So if someone's having an irregular cycle, the criteria in general is if they're really frequent, like less than every 21 days, or if they're longer than every 35 days. Now, there are exceptions to that rule. You know, when you get your first period, it's normal for there to be a couple of anovulatory cycles. It's like a car that you're just, you know, trying to get mm-hmm. it to start. It's normal. Your body's figuring out how to receive the signals from the brain, and it's working out its kinks. So there you can be a little bit more permissive. And, you know, you could go up to 3 months without a period, and that doesn't mean you're going to diagnose that 13-year-old with PCOS. Mm-hmm. After that first year, particularly after 3 years from the onset of menarche or the first menstrual cycle, that's when you can really judge whether someone has irregular or long cycles. It's really rare that someone wouldn't get their period and that would be the first manifestation of PCOS. Most mm-hmm. often PCOS, if it's severe enough to stop you from getting a period or ovulating at all, it's going to be a cause of secondary amenorrhea, meaning you had your period at one point, but then it became very infrequent or absent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's important to, even if you're not, trying to conceive is not on your radar, I would think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, even if trying to conceive is not on your radar, keep track of your menstrual cycles, use an app, do something, and every now and then visit it and see. You know, I'm pretty regular, or no, I'm not. Is something going on? Because, you know, if trying to conceive is not on your radar, you may not even be thinking about the fact that your periods are getting further apart or really irregular. And the other thing is, as a parent of a reproductive age person who's a teenager, who's busy, you know, ask them, tell me when your period starts. I'll keep track of it for you. Because this does happen in teens, and it gets diagnosed in teens and those in their early 20s. And as a parent, we can be involved in tracking their menstrual cycles as well. Do you think that would be something that would be helpful?
100%. I think the more you know, the better, right? Mm-hmm. And if there are things that you can do outside of those two traditional management pathways of being on the pill or actively trying to conceive and taking meds to make you ovulate, then you should do them. Things like visiting with a nutritionist, as I said, if you are overweight or obese, working towards maintaining a normal body weight. Mm-hmm. If you have other signs or symptoms of, you know, androgen excess, like acne, you should be tuning that up with a dermatologist. But if you know that it might be coming from a hormonal source, like high androgen levels, there are different types of birth control that have anti-androgen types of progesterone in them. Like Ocella or Yaz, for instance, you can add on different therapies like medications like spironolactone alongside the birth control pill to really help combat androgen-driven acne or excess hair growth. So it's a quality of life issue. Like, no one should actually have to suffer with the signs and symptoms of PCOS. It can be really disruptive to one's quality of life, and it should be really managed as a multidisciplinary approach.
And agreed. And I had this in my notes, but I didn't say, but it one of the things I wrote down is PCOS is complex with reproductive, metabolic, and psychological features. So it does have all those components, and it's something to consider, especially over time, because a young person may not even be thinking about the way they look, and then all of a sudden they do, and it can be damaging if they have excess hair or if they have bad acne from something like this. So it's important to address all aspects.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people aren't aware that there is a real association between PCOS, depression, and anxiety,
Absolutely.
and even other types of mental health issues like bipolar disease, which we don't really understand the link yet, but we know there's a definite association. And I think it's made worse when patients aren't aware of what's going on and that all of these things are connected.
Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned biochemical and clinical, wait, is that right? Is that the right? Biochemical and clinical hyperandrogenism. What's the difference between the two?
So biochemical is referring to the lab tests, right? So we can send off a battery of tests looking at total testosterone, other types of androgens that are lesser known to lay people, like androstenedione or DHEAS. These are coming from your adrenal glands, which sit, I'm pointing to my back in case you can't see, right on top of the kidney, on either side. And they produce the precursors for a lot of these sex hormones like estrogen and progesterone. And they can be elevated for a variety of reasons. The reason we send that off is really not so related to PCOS. It's also as part of that diagnosis of exclusion to rule out tumors in the ovary that could be producing a high level of testosterone. Sometimes they're so small you can't even see them yet on ultrasound, or tumors in the adrenal gland. Sometimes you can have enzyme problems in the pathway for making those hormones in your adrenal gland, where if there's a blockage, it builds up some of these androgens and that can cause some of these physical manifestations. So that's the biochemical part. The clinical part is actually much easier because someone tells me that they have acne and it has a specific distribution, typically around here. It's cyclic and worse, around certain parts of their periods. If they get periods, hair growth, nail pattern baldness, those are the clinical signs of hyperandrogenism or high androgen testosterone type levels. Also, I should mention that a lot of the labs that are looking at testosterone levels in women aren't very good at it. Testosterone assays are designed for men and male level testosterones. And so a common mistake or fallacy is when people send these levels off and they come back normal and they assume that everything is fine. You can have clinical signs of high androgen levels and have normal androgen levels in the blood work. So the clinical to me is much more important than what I see in the blood work. If the blood work is high and if it's astronomically high, then that usually is a sign of something more serious, an underlying tumor or something along those lines. But we do it for safety reasons and to exclude other diagnoses.
Got it. Okay, and then finally, the ultrasound that one would get to look at the ovaries. So it's my understanding that if you have the anovulation and the clinical or biochemical signs of hyperandrogenism, you don't need the
True.
ov right? So the I mean the ultrasound appearance of the ovaries. But talk a little bit about like that. You already mentioned it, but ultrasound is part of the workup as well, right?
Yes, ultrasound's part of the workup. And, to a seasoned REI, you look at an ovary and you're like, yeah, that screams PCOS. It's for whatever reason, there's tends to be a lot of follicles and they tend to be arranged in this neat little pattern or squished together along the periphery. That's the string of pearls sign. But the technical criteria, which ASRM, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, came out with this to just be a little bit more cut and dry about it. They said if you measure any follicles between 2 and 9 millimeters in size, and there's at least 12 or more in either ovary, that qualifies. Or if the ovarian volume is at 10 cc's or greater, then that also qualifies as well.
And then backtracking a little bit, one of the things that I hear is that, is it true, or did I ask, is it true that you can still have semi-regular menstrual cycles and not be ovulating?
So I've read that. I have yet to see it.
Okay.
I have yet to see it in practice. I've had some patients who've come to me and said, I'm getting regular periods, but I'm convinced that I'm not ovulating because I don't have all the signs and symptoms. But the way to rule that out is you do a progesterone check, right? Around the time, if someone's getting regular periods, then you use that first day of their menstrual period as kind of a landmark, right? And you can say, all right, well, now I'm going to check your levels 3 weeks from now, or based on what the interval of time is between the two cycles, you can judge when you think they probably ovulated. And in my experience, the progesterone level has always been up, which has confirmed that they did in fact ovulate. But I have read and heard this theory that it is possible, and of course, anything's possible, but I think that would be extremely rare. Usually, in order to get a bleed, what has to have happened is that progesterone levels went up and then they fell. And that withdrawal of progesterone caused that thickened lining to break down and shed. There's really no other way to get a significant enough bleed to call it a period.
Yeah, so I get that. I get asked that all the time. So,
Yeah.
It's a good explanation. And I'm not the one that goes through that, but I
Yeah.
understand. And so, yeah, I'm glad we talked about that because I do get that question a lot. So, I am sure you get this all the time. You have someone come to the office and they say, I have PCOS. My family practitioner, my general OBGYN said I have it. We tried Clomid. I'm just making this up. We
Yeah.
tried X, Y, and Z. So just start me on whatever I need to ovulate, and probably expect you to do that. However, you're seeing them for the first time. Are you going to double check to make sure that's really what the diagnosis is?
Yes.
Along with everything that we just mentioned, I'm sure the answer is yes. You've got to
Yeah.
do the proper workup yourself, especially once they come to you. And I'm the same way. I've had patients come to me for various pregnancy related reasons and say, I have this. This is what X, Y, and Z said. I still double check. I want to make
Yeah.
sure it's the right diagnosis, right? So, is there anything else? Assuming you're doing all the other workup, is there anything else you're going to look for in that infertile patient? Say the diagnosis of PCOS may even be confirmed. Is there anything else you're going to look at before initiating a fertility treatment plan?
100%. So we mentioned this earlier. I've had this happen multiple times where a patient, they think it's like a slam dunk diagnosis. They were told they had PCOS. And I'm like, well, I looked through the records and I never saw a prolactin checked. And so I'll check their prolactin and it was elevated. Prolactin is a hormone that comes from a small gland, it comes from the pituitary gland. And it basically is a hormone that's important for lactation. It's important in pregnancy, actually. And sometimes you can have a benign growth in the pituitary gland that secretes this at a very high level. And somehow it causes a shutdown of the other signals that your pituitary gland normally should send to your ovary to tell it to ovulate. So the way that I'm first clued into this is I always check LH levels, luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone levels. And if someone has a high prolactin level that's suppressing those levels, they're going to come back like less than five, right? And typically women with PCOS have high levels of not so much FSH, but definitely LH, because it's almost like their brain's working overtime to say, hey, ovary, listen to me, ovulate. Why aren't you doing what I want you to do? So if those levels are low, that's usually the first tip off that this is probably not PCOS. Either it's prolactin or it's some other reason why those levels are low, which there can be many reasons, which we can talk about. But the prolactin levels should be rechecked because they can be falsely elevated. Anything can make them go up, nipple stimulation, recent sex, having a meal. So we always say, come back fasting and let's recheck it. And if it's elevated to a certain degree, we'll have you do an MRI of the brain. And there's a very easy way to treat it if you are found to have a small, adenoma is what we call it, that produces high levels of prolactin. And if we get those levels to be under control, it could restore normal ovulation, right? So this is a very simple fix and definitely needs to be looked into. It's again, going back to the diagnosis of exclusion, you got to rule that out.
And then, obviously, and someone does have PCOS before, obviously trying to conceive and then potentially getting pregnant when I'm potentially seeing them, making sure there is no aspect of diabetes there and blood glucose is control because if it's not, and they get pregnant, they could still lead to miscarriage based on uncontrolled diabetes. Making
Yes, and
sure
the
weight
thyroid.
and the thyroid, making sure the thyroid levels are normal, making sure the weight's optimal, blood pressure checks as well, along with the metabolic aspect of PCOS. There could be some high blood pressure there. That's always good to check. And then other things, you know, just the basics. Are the tubes patent? Is there anything else that could be contributing to all this before we get everything going? You know, those are kind of all the things that need to be done, even if we think it's a slam dunk diagnosis, because you don't want to leave anything out before you start that fertility treatment plan, right?
Right. And sometimes patients come to me not only with their diagnosis, but maybe their general OBGYN already started them on medication to get them to ovulate, which is well and good. But oftentimes everyone hones in on the most obvious thing, which is these are, you know, these cycles are irregular and you don't know when you're ovulating and that's why I'm not getting pregnant. But it's completely possible to have a combination of factors, like you said. So definitely a semen analysis for your partner. It's such an easy test to get. Just to make sure you actually have sperm to work with before you do the hard work of getting your body to ovulate on time. And then making sure the tubes are open and unblocked and unscarred. Even if one tube is blocked, it's important to know that because if there's a buildup of fluid behind it, that might detract from your chances as well. And that's not always obvious on ultrasound.
So there's a lot of things that go into the whole, you know, diagnosis, and once the diagnosis is made, making sure everything's in order before any fertility treatment plan is initiated. So, and I get this all the time, you know, I've already had this workup. Why are you doing it again? You're just wasting my time. We're not wasting time. You want to make sure you're doing the right thing for the patient.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, the hallmark, you know, once we have the diagnosis, everything else has been ruled out. It's definitely PCOS and ovulation, or, you know, suboptimal ovulation, or, you know, irregular menstrual cycles. From what I understand, the mainstay is ovulation induction.
Correct.
So what would be the first thing you would approach as far as, you know, in the treatment plan for someone that has PCOS?
So the first line treatment for PCOS causing irregular cycles when you're trying to conceive is using an oral medication. My first line go-to is a medication called letrozole. And this is a medication that basically fools, well, it doesn't fool your brain. It actually blocks the conversion of testosterone or androgens to estrogen. So it gives your brain the impression, your pituitary gland, the impression that there's very low estrogen levels. It's almost falsely lowering the estrogen levels. So it prompts your pituitary gland to crank out more of that hormonal signal, the FSH and LH, to a level that will hopefully overcome the blockage in communication. PCOS is basically an ovary or ovaries that do what they want to do when they want to do it, and they don't always listen. And you just need to get through that communication blockage by making that signal stronger. And so it's a pill that you take for 5 days. Typically, if you're someone that does get periods, we'll start this on day two or day three of your period. It's really important to do a pregnancy test. We typically in our fertility clinic setting do blood work to make sure hormonally someone is at the right part of their cycle, because it can be confusing with irregular cycles. And we always want to rule out pregnancy before we start this. And they're on it for 5 days, and they come in like 4 to 5 days after taking that last pill. So mid-cycle, right? And we do an ultrasound. You don't have to always do that, but we like to do that because a lot of women with PCOS are young, so they probably have good egg quality. And they may have a high egg count, so they might be predisposed to over-responding. And we want to see, okay, do you have one, two, three eggs? How many eggs look like they're now in this follicle that's big enough to actually yield a mature egg and ovulate? And so we're making sure it's safe by doing the ultrasound monitoring. We're also making sure that you actually responded to the medication. And we're also making sure that the timing is correct because you want to make sure that you're triggering the release of a mature egg. And you don't have to do this, but often with PCOS, I like to give a trigger shot, which is basically mimicking the LH signal that's supposed to tell a mature follicle to release an egg. And we know how long it takes for that trigger shot to work. So it gives us kind of a window of opportunity to say, okay, if your partner had a normal semen analysis, great. Now all we need to do is tell you when to have sex. So we're giving you the shot now. You have a 2-day window to go home, have sex, and try so that you can be exposed to sperm at the right part of your cycle. And 2 weeks down the road, either they're pregnant and we will monitor the early pregnancy and discharge them to their OB, or they're not and they'll get a period and the whole cycle begins again. I always tell patients it's not really doing anything in the way of changing egg quality. It's just getting you the opportunity that people who regularly ovulate have every month, which is about a 15% chance of getting pregnant with one ovulated egg every month. I'm just trying to get them on that schedule because if they're only getting a period every 90 days, they're only getting that 15% chance like three times a year, four times a year. That's not fair.
Yeah. Okay. So that letrozole, is that something that a generalist can do as well? Is that mostly done by physicians such as yourself?
So a generalist can do it, but whenever someone comes to me and says, my GYN gave me letrozole for 2 or 3 months, I always ask, did they monitor to see if you responded? Because sometimes it's not enough. That signal that's being cranked out at a higher level still isn't enough to get through. So how do I know they even responded?
Yeah,
I kind of feel like I'm starting from scratch unless monitoring was done.
Right. And what about the role of clomiphene? Clomid.
So Clomid is another type of oral ovulation induction agent. It's another medication that you can take very similar to letrozole. It's a pill that you take for 5 days. The mechanism of action is a little bit different. It is the actual one that fools your brain into thinking there isn't enough estrogen. It blocks one of the receptors on your brain so it can't see the estrogen that's there. And then it cranks out more signals. So it's kind of the same principle. Mm. And it's doing the exact same thing. It tends to have worse side effect profile, not across the board. A lot of my patients do fine with either option. But it tends to have more adverse effects on like the lining of the uterus because it acts as an estrogen antagonist. It blocks the role of estrogen in the lining. So sometimes it'll cause a thin lining, which can't be good. So we always, you know, start with letrozole in women with PCOS. Based on actual data, there was a huge randomized controlled trial that looked at letrozole versus Clomid head-to-head in women with PCOS. And the letrozole group had a higher live birth rate. Also, another potential benefit is that there tends to be less follicles that are developed because the issue in PCOS isn't really that you need to be more aggressive and release more eggs. It's that you just want to get on a regular schedule. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lower risk of twins with letrozole overall than Clomid. So it's our first line, but, you know, if someone doesn't respond to letrozole, I'll always try Clomid just because it's slightly different mechanism of action. You might have better results.
And then what about metformin? Back in the day, that was, I remember that becoming a huge thing. And now I'm sure it's, you know, things have changed so much, but it's still out there. What about the role of metformin in someone with PCOS?
Right. So metformin is a drug that can be used in diabetes, but it's also a drug that can be used in women with PCOS, especially those who exhibit insulin resistance, right? So insulin is a drug, is a hormone that is produced by your pancreas, and it helps your body utilize and store sugars. So people with diabetes lack insulin or don't respond well to insulin, and they have high sugar levels, which are dangerous for them. For whatever reason, there tends to be high insulin levels and an overall pattern of resistance to the actions of insulin in the body of someone with PCOS. Mm-hmm. Not everyone will have this, but they're definitely at higher risk. And we know that giving medication like metformin can sensitize the cells of their body to the actions of insulin, which will help to lower the high insulin levels because your body's going to keep pumping out whatever it needs to get your cells to listen and do their job. Mm-hmm. So those high insulin levels tend to result in higher androgen levels being produced from the ovary, and that's the link between the metabolic and the androgen component of PCOS. So by giving someone metformin, it can be very helpful if they have insulin resistance to help restore normal androgen levels and kind of stop this vicious cycle. It can help to restore normal ovulation. We typically will use it in women who have overt signs of insulin resistance. So if they have a 2-hour glucose tolerance test that's abnormal, it doesn't have to be in diabetic range. There's a range that's lesser than diabetes that shows that they could benefit from metformin. And women who are resistant to Clomid. Like if they're taking Clomid or they're taking letrozole and you're not getting the results that you want, you can add metformin on, especially if you think they're insulin resistant, you know, and it may help. It may help to get that signal through to the ovary better.
Yeah. And we were talking about this, or I meant to mention it earlier, diagnosing insulin resistance is not a criteria to diagnose someone with PCOS, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Correct.
So that's important to know. And then finally, one other thing, AMH levels. What is the role of getting an AMH level in diagnosing PCOS?
So there's no role for testing AMH as part of the diagnosis. I always check it in every patient because it just gives me information. If push came to shove and they needed treatment, particularly IVF, it's going to help me figure out the right dose of medication to give them. Women with PCOS do have a tendency towards having very high AMH levels and high ovarian reserve. And the typical thing that patients will conclude when I tell them that is, oh, it's because I'm not ovulating. I'm stocking up all my eggs. And that's why I have a high count. And I'm like, well, that's not true, because then we would put everyone on birth control instead of freezing their eggs. We know that that's not how it works. There have been lots of interesting recent studies that have come out looking at women with PCOS and finding AMH receptor mutations. So AMH has a role that a lot of people don't think about, because it's become very hot in the arena of thinking about, you know, testing egg count and what that means for egg freezing cycles and IVF. But AMH's role is actually to prevent you from recruiting all of your eggs at one time, right? And it's like the gatekeeper of ovulation and recruitment of eggs. And so we know that there's some sort of impaired mechanism there. And a lot of women with PCOS do have mutations in AMH or the AMH receptor or that pathway. And we still are trying to learn more about this. We don't quite fully understand it. I always tell my patients, sometimes it's the silver lining of PCOS. It doesn't, they don't have to go hand in hand, but because there tends to be this association, it's always beneficial in my mind, especially to someone who has known PCOS and they're going to go through an egg freezing cycle. Right. It's nice to know that you're going to get a high number of eggs from one cycle, but it's not a necessity to diagnose PCOS. You're right.
Gotcha. Okay. So what gonadotropins, when someone sees the word gonadotropins, is that meaning injectable medications to help you ovulate?
Correct.
Okay. So what is the role, what is the role of doing the injectable gonadotropins in someone with PCOS?
So injectable gonadotropins are basically injecting your body with that FSH and LH signal that your pituitary gland should be sending to your ovary. So instead of gaming the system, fooling your brain into thinking there's not enough estrogen, or falsely lowering the estrogen level so the signal's stronger, just go ahead and bypass all that and inject yourself with that signal. And it should work really well. So this is something traditionally that was reserved for patients that tried Clomid, maybe they tried Letrozole, maybe they tried that all with metformin, and they're still, nothing is budging. The ovary is not listening. So if you just give the signal directly, it really can't ignore that, right? So it does work really well in those cases. I rarely use injectable gonadotropins because, A, they're very expensive. They're the same type of meds that are used for IVF. And doing this type of a cycle, yes, it's going to be more aggressive because it tends to produce more eggs at time of ovulation, but it's still not going to be the most efficient treatment option. So you're buying these expensive medications, and you're likely going to have to do this type of round of stimulation multiple times to get pregnant, because if one follicle gives you like a 15% chance of success, well, you know, it's reasonable to think you might have to do this multiple times to get there. The other thing that I hate about it is that because it produces such a robust response, it's dangerous, right? You might have an over response. And so therefore we have to torture you with multiple visits. Patients who are on injectable gonadotropins for IUI cycles or timed intercourse cycles for the purpose of PCOS, I'm bringing them in like every other day for not just ultrasound, but blood work. And I might have to cancel them at the end of all of that because they have six follicles and I don't want them to have triplets, right? So at that point, if we're starting to get into that phase of treatment and talking about injectable gonadotropins, I oftentimes will start to recommend IVF because it might just be more efficient. I know it's expensive and it's not always covered by insurance, but at the end of the day, it might be the safer route because you're going to take those same injections, but at least we're not worried about releasing multiple eggs. We can just extract those eggs, turn them into embryos, freeze them all, let your body cool off and all those hormone levels to come down. So you're not worried about ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome and things like that. And then put back one embryo at a time in a calm, collected fashion. And then you don't, in future, whenever you want to get pregnant, have to worry about futzing around and getting your body to ovulate when it was so difficult.
So it sounds like, you know, someone that has PCOS, you start with the oral medications, then to the injectables if necessary, and then lastly would be IVF as third line. Does that sound about right?
Yes. Yeah. Now, the caveat is someone who comes to me with PCOS and they're older, and they might have background underlying egg quality issues, in which case it might make sense to just go straight to IVF.
Straight to IVF,
going to allow you to genetically test the embryos if you want to, and it's a whole different ball game. Also, the caveats are obviously like if there's tubal factor or male factor infertility, which is better served, you know, to be treated by IVF.
Yeah. So there's other things to look at too. I mean, with anything that you're doing, I've been through that myself, you know, before going straight to IVF. But and every time I talk about anything related to fertility, I just want everyone to, I do my little blurb here. Going to see a fertility specialist like Dr. Sikhan for any reason does not mean they're going to automatically sign you up for IVF. That's a common misconception. That's simply not true. Their goal is to help you to conceive, and the minimal amount of time or medications, whatever you call it, is possible. It does not mean they're going to stamp you on forehead and put you on the assembly line to IVF. So, you know, especially in someone that potentially has PCOS and has all these other factors involved, going to an expert is valuable to talk to them so that you can get the best bang for your buck and get an accurate diagnosis.
Exactly. I think it's frustrating at baseline. I want anyone who's listening to this who has PCOS to feel validated and heard, because I, as a reproductive endocrinologist, know firsthand from sitting across the desk from you, I know it's frustrating that something a lot of people take for granted that they can just do on their own. You know, you have to take medication and you need to come in for monitoring and you feel medicalized. That is not something that's lost on me. And I think it's important to go to a doctor where you feel validated and they understand the journey. It can be very fatiguing, you know, to just get yourself in the game by having to take these medications and do all of the things. And it's a marathon. And I think you have to make sure you find a good care team that you feel supported by and who's going to take a multidisciplinary approach.
Agreed. You know,
because it's not... Yeah. It is a multifaceted disorder, and it's important to kind of approach it from all angles. You're going to get the most out of it.
Yeah, agreed. I just wanted to touch a little bit on PCOS and pregnancy, you know, and I have some stats here. So basically, have someone that does have PCOS is at increased risk for adverse pregnancy outcomes. We're not exactly sure why, but it's probably a combination of having hyperandrogenism. Having those excess androgens itself can lead to adverse pregnancy outcomes, both for the pregnant individual and the fetus as well. Then obesity, if obesity is a factor with PCOS, the insulin resistance. And then finally, any of the other metabolic abnormalities that go along with PCOS, all of that together can contribute to an individual's risk for having adverse pregnancy outcomes once they get pregnant and someone that has PCOS. Increased risk for miscarriage. And I've seen some comments here that they weren't diagnosed until having several miscarriages. I got asked a question about the increased risk of stillbirth. And yes, there is a potential increased risk of stillbirth. We don't know exactly the reason why, but it's more likely related to the increased risk of pregnancy complications related to the hyperandrogenism and the metabolic issues like diabetes and high blood pressure, especially if they're not controlled. That's what is probably tying into the increased risk of miscarriage and pregnancy loss. You do have an increased risk of gestational diabetes for all the things that we just talked about. You may not have entered the pregnancy as someone with PCOS with a diagnosis of diabetes, but you're definitely at increased risk for developing it. So that's something that the obstetrician or whoever's seeing you should be aware of. Also increased risk for the hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, anywhere from gestational hypertension, which means the high blood pressure develops in pregnancy, all the way up to preeclampsia and all the things that go along with preeclampsia. And then there's also, and I just read about this actually over the past couple of days, there's an increased risk of placental abnormalities. This is kind of new. Have you heard about this?
Yeah.
So women with PCOS or individuals with PCOS have shown placental inflammation, placental thrombosis, which means some blood clotting in the placenta, and infarction, or where the blood flow is not optimal in the placenta. And there can be some altered vascular changes. Now, if you think about it, and again, this is just me knowing what I know about the placenta in pregnancy, someone with PCOS and metabolic issues have an increased risk for preeclampsia. It all goes along with the small vessels in the placenta and having issues with the placental blood flow that's kind of similar to what goes on with preeclampsia. So that's probably how it's all tied in. So if I have someone that comes in to see me that's pregnant, with or without the assistance of fertility treatments, and they have PCOS, you know, those are all things that I'm going to be aware of. You know, my patient population, I already do an early glucose tolerance test on entry to care. That's just based on my patient population alone, but that is recommended in everyone with PCOS. If that's negative, it needs to be repeated again or around 26 to 28 weeks to make sure you don't have gestational diabetes. Also watching the blood pressures. Now, if someone with PCOS comes in with already diagnosed high blood pressure, already diagnosed diabetes, that needs to be optimally controlled, ideally, before the pregnancy starts. So if you already have PCOS and you're going to someone like Dr. Seekon, and you have already existing diabetes or high blood pressure, they may call you, say, you know what, go see an MFM for a preconception consult so we can get all of this optimally controlled before we either, you know, start the fertility treatments. Right? I mean, I know you guys, yes. I get those consults all the time. It's important for those with pre-existing medical conditions related to PCOS, right?
Yes, it is. And I think only recently has the link between PCOS and pregnancy complications really come to light.
Yeah.
I think traditionally everyone just thought about gestational diabetes, but all of these placental changes, it all makes sense because it's this pro-inflammatory environment.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's metabolic. Mm-hmm. And things like obesity are an independent risk factor for all of these complications.
Right. And then the other one would be preterm birth. And that's more likely due to the necessity to deliver preterm because of complications from diabetes and or high blood pressure. So, you know, it's PCOS. I just want to get the mention. I know we talk about some very scary things. It doesn't mean it's going to happen to everyone with PCOS. I think education and knowledge is power, and it's empowering as someone who's trying to conceive and then subsequently gets pregnant. Having the right care team in place to help you get through this so that you know what to look for, and we know what to look for as your providers. I think that's very important. I don't want to sound negative or, you know, it's you're a ticking time bomb, right? I think it's important to get that message across.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Another major PSA that I want to say is that I think a lot of people feel like failures when they do all the things. They try to institute a low-carb diet. They try to lose weight, and their cycles still aren't regular. I think it's really important for people to understand that there's only so much you can control. Some of it is just the way your body is wired, despite your best efforts. And sometimes you just need a little bit of help from medicine and science, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, it isn't always possible to self-treat or self-regulate. And I think there's so much misinformation online.
Yes.
People are like selling herbal teas and supplements and this diet and that. You can't always change it. You can't always fix it yourself. And it's okay to ask for help.
So this is actually a question I got sent. Are there any dietary recommendations specific to PCOS and fertility? And that's likely coming from... you can talk about what you know to be true, but it's also coming from what's out there on social media from a lot of our nutritionist and fertility expert friends, if you will, on social media. So what would be your answer to that, the dietary recommendations for PCOS?
So it's a very boring answer. It's like not the sexy answer, but it's having a healthy, balanced diet. A Mediterranean-style diet is best because that's going to be high in, you know, fruits, vegetables, healthy types of carbs like whole grain, pasta, rice, quinoa. I think it's important to pair the healthy carbs with a source of protein because that's going to keep you full for longer. But, you know, it's very common sense. There is no magic superfood that's best for PCOS, and there certainly is no magic teas or supplements.
No magic supplements, right. And then another one said, are there any supplements that is shown to help PCOS and regulating cycles? I've seen so many influencers say different diets, supplements, teas. I'm skeptical. And it's, I see it on social media. So,
there's a whole industry built around this.
Yeah. It's a whole industry and it's expensive. It's somewhat, and I don't want to use it, but it's some way it's a little bit of voodoo. It is. And it's not fair to keep making people think that you need to buy this to fix yourself or you're not doing enough. And I really hate that messaging from anyone that has a link in bio to a supplement that they're selling to cure your PCOS. You have to think about that, guys, when you're following these people and taking their advice. If the answer is to buy something from them, that's not where you should be getting your advice and your information from. It's simply not. One of the other questions I does getting pregnant fix PCOS?
No, I mean, getting pregnant is a huge shift in your body, right? So there are definite changes that can happen as a result of the pregnancy, but in general, there's no mechanism by which the pregnancy itself is going to correct or change anything about the underlying PCOS. Some women who have well-controlled PCOS and maintain a normal body weight, who gain weight during the pregnancy as they should, and maybe they keep on some of that weight after the fact, that might precipitate PCOS because, gaining a certain amount of weight just might tip you over that set point where now there's a metabolic derangement and you start to have irregular cycles. And that can be confusing too if they're like breastfeeding, because breastfeeding independently is going to make their cycle irregular or absent. I think if anything, it's going to mask it, right? Because just like birth control masks PCOS, I have patients who, for whatever reason, aren't ovulating either because they were pregnant or they were on birth, not, sorry, not menstruating, because they're on birth control, they have a Mirena IUD, or they've been pregnant. That means you're not in the game, you're not cycling, so there's no way to assess how often you would have ovulated if you weren't pregnant or if you didn't have the IUD. So it's basically just masking what normally would happen with your cycle during the pregnancy, but it's not necessarily fixing anything.
This is probably the last question here. Can you explain the relationship of birth control and PCOS when it's used as a treatment? Well, first of all, is birth control a treatment for PCOS?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, yes. It can help to regulate your cycle. One thing we haven't talked about, which is really important, is even if you're not trying to get pregnant, the reason it's important to balance out the estrogen with some progesterone is because your lining of your uterus thickens as a result of estrogen. And there's estrogen coming from our ovaries, there's estrogen coming from the fat, the peripheral fat in our body. It's being converted from androgens or testosterone by an enzyme. And so that estrogen is always causing your lining to thicken up and build up. The thing that makes you shed it is exposure of your lining to progesterone, and then when the progesterone goes away, it breaks down and sheds. So if you're someone who never gets a period, or you only get a period like every 4 months, you're prone to having a chronic buildup of your lining, and that can actually be dangerous. That chronic unopposed estrogen that's never balanced out by progesterone can transform that lining into cancerous cells. So the patients who are young who get uterine cancer, and again, I'm not trying to fearmonger, but it's important to know this. If you're young and you don't get periods, it's important to have your lining be shed. You don't have to be on birth control. Maybe you'll just take a course of progesterone only for 10 days every once in a while to shed your lining. And those are the patients who, even though they're young, should consider having an endometrial biopsy, a sampling of their lining, because those are the types of patients that are at high risk. So it's kind of a protective thing. By taking birth control, it can be helpful because, A, if you're not trying to get pregnant, then I'm thinking that you probably want to prevent an unplanned pregnancy. And you might sporadically ovulate and not know about it. And if you're not using protection, especially, you could get pregnant. Secondly, you always want to make sure you're balancing out the estrogen with progesterone. And third, if you have bothersome manifestations of PCOS, like acne or excess hair growth, birth control pills can help, because giving yourself the birth control pill will increase the amount of protein in your blood that actually binds excess androgens that are free and that are actually the cause behind why you're having these symptoms like acne. And it will lower the effects of testosterone or androgens, and it can help with some of those symptoms. So there are many reasons to be on birth control if you're someone who has frequent cycles, known PCOS, and you're not trying to conceive.
So, one more question that I have, and then we'll close up shop here. And I always talk about this too. There is a role for the general OBGYN when it comes to infertility issues. There are things that they can do. Some generalists, general OBGYNs, do more of it than others. But they're not the experts, especially when the fertility issues become more complex, as with PCOS. So, what would be your recommendation for someone who has been told they have PCOS and they're starting to take these medications to their general OBGYN? Is there a certain time frame you would say, you know what, it's time to get a more in-depth evaluation by someone that does fertility, like yourself? Do you have a recommendation regarding that?
Yeah, I think if you just talk generally, like without having gone to your general GYN for initiating actual treatment, I have patients who come to me after a year, even though they never got a period, or they only got 2 periods that entire year because they said the definition of infertility under the age of 35 is 1 year of trying. If you're not getting regular cycles, you should go to a doctor right away, in my opinion, to avoid
that applies that up the year thing that you hear applies if you're having regular menstrual cycles.
Correct.
If you start off not having them, you've got to figure out why that is.
Correct. Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, if the workup's been done and they've been seeing their own doctor, and they've been giving them letrozole and they were getting a bleed every time, honestly, there's no rule book, but I would say after, if you're especially over the age of 35, I would go no longer than 3 months of doing that because you just don't want to waste time. And how do you know you're actually pinpointing the window if they're not monitored cycles and maybe it's not their area of expertise? So I would just want to get an expert on board, a specialist. I think if you're younger and you're getting reliable periods that lead you to believe, yes, this is actually inducing ovulation, maybe you could go for as long as 6 months, but I just feel like earlier is better, even as a sanity check to make sure you're on the right track and you're actually responding appropriately.
Yeah, I think that's good advice, you know, and I'm not trying to downplay the role that a general OBGYN has in managing and diagnosing fertility, but general OBGYN field is so broad and they're not specialists in fertility. And we need to make sure, even as general OBGYNs, that we make the appropriate referral when it's time. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. We got to do what's best for our patients. And as a patient, you know, starting to ask, hey, when should I start to go? When should I go see a fertility? Do you recommend I should, you know, or advocate for yourself? You don't need a referral that I know of to see a fertility specialist, right?
You don't.
So, yeah, you don't need a referral. So it's as someone that's been through fertility issues, I always recommend seeing them sooner than later. And again, it does not mean they're going to sign you up for thousands and thousands of dollars of fertility treatments. I've seen several instances where it was just a matter of drawing the right blood work, making some recommendations, and that's all it took.
Yeah.
And that does happen. But they're the experts. So that's why I highly endorse making sure that you see someone like Dr. Seacom sooner than later.
I agree. And I completely echo your sentiments about getting the full reproductive checkup and not just ignoring every other issue that could, you know, be at play and focusing on the ovulation aspect. Yeah. I think that's the best advice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. This is a great topic and a great conversation, as always, that I have with you. So if anybody has any questions, this video will be posted on my Instagram feed. You could put them under there and, you know, we'll try to answer. I won't be me answering if Dr. Seacon has time to go to the comments and answer.
No, I definitely will.
Yeah, answer some of the questions. But again, thank you so much. I hope you have a beautiful week. And thank you again for spending some of your time with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And if any of you have questions you don't want to ask in the comments, you can DM me directly as well.
Oh, yes. Tell them where they can find you on Instagram.
Yes. Yeah. So my handle is at Lucky, L-U-C-K-Y dot S-E-K-H-O-N. That's my last name. And I also have my personal website, theluckyegg.com. It's where I post, you know, my personal opinions, my professional opinions on various issues as it pertains to fertility. So check that out. And I hope to see you all soon.
And right, and one more thing, COVID vaccine when trying to conceive and undergoing fertility treatments, yay or nay?
Yay, always a yay. And if the booster becomes available, yay to that too, because the exact same thing with the exact same mechanism. We know it's safe, we know it doesn't cause miscarriages, and we know that pregnancy is an independent risk factor for more severe disease. So we want you to be safe and stay healthy, and we recommend it across the board.
Bravo. All right, that's it. That's all I got. Thank you so much, Dr. Seacom.
All right, bye. Have a good night.
Bye. You too. I hope you enjoyed that discussion. Now listen to the next episode on heart health and the preconception, pregnancy, and postpartum periods, and health disparities.